All persons having business with the Honorable United States Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for this court is now in session. God save the United States and this Honorable Court. Please be seated.
Good morning, counsel. We have one case for this morning, Rinaldi v. United States, number 16-1080. Ms. Ackerman?
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Tara Ackerman from Jones Day. We are pleased to represent the appellant, Mr. Rinaldi. I have reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal.
That will be granted.
This appeal arises from the dismissal by the district court, partially on a motion to dismiss and partially on summary judgment of a complaint filed by Mr. Rinaldi. Mr. Rinaldi appeals the dismissal of four claims based upon two factual circumstances that unfolded while he was incarcerated by the BOP at USP Lewisburg.
Ms. Ackerman, on the exhaustion arguments, there are a few points of clarification maybe you could give us as to the record.
Of course.
And we'll get the government's position as well. The record isn't clear what notice was given to Rinaldi regarding the regional administrator's rejection. Is it your position that he had the opportunity to refile in Lewisburg and would have been required to under 541.14d, except that that was not available because of the third exception to Ross?
That is our position. There's no evidence in the record, nor does Mr. Rinaldi contend that he was unaware of the rejection. Mr. Rinaldi rather argues that because of the retaliation that he had experienced at the institution level, he was unable to refile for fear of further retaliation.
Okay, so there's no argument on your part that he properly exhausted because he didn't have the opportunity to refile.
That's correct.
Okay.
What was actually done at the on the sensitive filing? I'm unclear as to what, I mean, there seems to be a major dispute as to what the rejection or the denial was and whether it got to the merits or didn't get to the merits.
The rejection of Mr. Rinaldi's retaliation is the sensitive one.
Exactly.
Right. There was no merits decision on the sensitive grievance. That was dismissed as procedurally inappropriate.
Was that wrong?
That we contend that that was incorrect because it was indeed a sensitive filing and should have been treated as such. And when it was rejected as not actually being sensitive, Mr. Rinaldi, then the result was that
does the record show that it was rejected?
It does, I believe it does, yes.
Was any explanation given?
I'm not entirely, I don't believe so. I believe that it was just rejected. I can take a look if you'd like. I do believe it was just rejected.
But there's no dispute that he was notified of that and advised of his opportunity to refile his work.
That's correct. There is no dispute of that. And to be clear, yes, there was no reason given. There's just a code of rejected.
And then he took an appeal to the general counsel.
Yes.
And what happened there?
He had not heard. He has never heard back from the general counsel.
And what did that mean?
We contend really that the general counsel's response doesn't matter because
doesn't that amount to a rejection if you don't hear from general counsel?
Mr. Rinaldi contended in the district court that based upon the BOP regulations, failure to respond to an appeal is considered a denial. And BOP regulations do state that. However,
in all cases, I thought that was qualified. Maybe I'm wrong on that.
I believe that a properly appealed grievance that is not responded to is a denial. My opposing counsel can clear that up because I'm not entirely sure. However, it's our position that it is really of no consequence whether it was a rejection or a denial with the general counsel because Mr. Rinaldi had no right to appeal the procedural rejection of his sensitive issue filing under BOP regulations. And as a result, his appeal was technically also procedurally incorrect. However,
well, doesn't he need to exhaust one way or the other? That is, either appealing through the general counsel or refiling. And we can talk about unavailability if required to refile, but wouldn't exhaustion be required one way or the other?
Yes, exhaustion would normally, without unavailability, be required. And under the BOP regulations, he would have been required to refile.
So is it a problem for your client that, as I understand it, the record does not reflect that there, at least the BOP doesn't have a record that he filed the appeal with the general counsel?
No. Based upon the argument under Ross that the entire process was unavailable to him, the unavailability of the record of this appeal is really of consequence. Mr. Rinaldi does not contest that the technical procedural process that he went through on his sensitive issue grievance after it was rejected was technically incorrect under BOP policy.
So. In your view, Ross says that if you file a sensitive appeal and it is rejected, then the exhaustion requirement is completely done away with. You don't need to do it.
As a general matter, it is not our position that Ross says that. It is our position that Ross says that if the factual circumstance indicate that a prisoner was thwarted from filing under the proper grievance procedure.
Thwarted or placed in a difficult position?
Our position would be whether the factual situation was one that actually prevented the prisoner from filing under the proper procedure, and then that is excused in this circumstance.
Because he might get further retaliation.
Correct.
In this circumstance, that's the first level. So it's a bypass under those circumstances.
Correct. Under the circumstances where, among other things, intimidation by prison officials prevents a prisoner from filing under the proper procedure, i.e. at the institution level, filing with the very people that are retaliating against him for filing grievances, then in those circumstances, Ross provides...
Okay. Well, you mentioned intimidation. That has a lot of different meanings because
right.
He did file a number of proceedings even after all of this, and they were considered, so he wasn't intimidated from filing other grievances.
That's correct. And the other grievances that he did file and fully exhaust after this were largely innocuous situations. He was asking for cleaning products for his cell. He asked for a warmer cell. He asked to be transferred to a halfway house. And it's actually, in my opinion, these additional grievances that he filed afterwards were actually evidence that he was thwarted from filing this grievance. Clearly, Mr. Rinaldi knows how to use the BOP's grievance process.
Thwarted. And he chose... Is thwart the right word in this instance?
He was deterred from filing this grievance. This grievance, the facts of this grievance were the exact issues that he claims were preventing him from filing it.
Are you conceding with the argument that there is a requirement of subjective deterrence?
I actually take no position on whether there's a requirement for subjective or objective, because I think it's important to note that it's the appellee's burden here to prove that Mr. Rinaldi was not deterred here. It's the appellee's burden to prove that there was not proper exhaustion.
But if there is a subjective component, you have an additional hurdle to get over the client.
Agreed.
And if we are going to reach this point, we need to adopt a test one way or the other.
Agreed.
So we welcome your input in whether it is purely an objective test. What role a subjective component has, given the difficulties with making credibility determinations, and given the circumstances when this would even come up, where someone has already declined to file so that arguably there's already prima facie evidence of subjective deterrence.
Precisely. My position on that would be that in circumstances where you are looking at a situation where the inmate has not filed and is now claiming he was deterred from doing so, the proper review would simply be whether he was reasonable in reaching that conclusion for the very point that you pose, that the very fact that this inmate chose not to file this grievance in the institution level is evidence on its face of his subjective deterrence.
Do you take into account his record? I mean, as I understand that he has a record of numerous filings. One of the first decisions we have to make is was he deterred from filing? But do we take into account his record, which seems to suggest that nothing is going to deter Mr. Rinaldi from filing a complaint?
If this panel does choose to look at the subjective test...
Let me also ask you this. Is this something for the district court to decide, or can we decide based on the record we have?
I believe that there's a serious factual disagreement here between Appelli's position on Mr. Rinaldi's personal deterrence and Mr. Rinaldi's position on whether or not he was actually deterred. I do believe that if there is actual factual contentions here, that this is something the district court should consider. There should be discovery on whether or not Mr. Rinaldi was indeed deterred. But nonetheless, I do think that the evidence exists to prove in Mr. Rinaldi's favor that he was actually deterred, for the very reason that Your Honor just stated, that he has a very long track record of filing numerous grievances. He knows how to use the process, and he's clearly not easily deterred. But in this circumstance, he chose not to. Why? Why would he do that? Even after he was told by the regional office that he may lose his right to bring this in court if he didn't refile at the institution level.
Does it matter that the regional office considered the merits of the case?
The regional office did not consider the merits of the case of this sensitive grievance.
But the retaliation?
The retaliation, they did consider the merits. And that is very important to that claim. And that claim, the fact that they considered the merits, is evidence entirely under Camp versus Brennan that the BOP has actually waived their right to claim that.
That was brought up for the first time on appeal.
Mr. Rinaldi was not represented below, and therefore had less of an ability to bring that argument. I see my time is up. But
you're on your time as long as my colleagues have any questions.
May I ask you to point to language or the record that would show that they considered it on the merits?
Yes. The regional office appeal did directly address this additional allegation in Mr. Rinaldi's appeal. They noted that he appealed the warden's decision and had additionally claimed that he was placed in a cell with an inmate who had previously threatened to kill him.
Counselor, just to be clear, because you referenced this as the retaliation complaint.
Yes.
But we were previously, if I understand your arguments correctly, what we've been discussing for the last 12 minutes or so was the First Amendment retaliation complaint. That was the sensitive complaint.
That is correct.
Directly to the regional administrator. Now you're talking about the Eighth Amendment assault complaint, correct?
That is correct.
Okay.
Yes.
Oh, all right. And
yes,
you might as well finish, but then I'm interested in the retaliation. Are you saying that the retaliation claim was not considered on the merits?
That is correct.
Okay,
Yes. The regional office did, however, address the additional allegations within its response to this appeal for the Eighth Amendment grievance. In addition to that, the BOP places very meaningful difference between the word denied and the word rejected, as appellees have pointed out throughout this case. This denial just does that, denies every allegation brought in the Rinaldi's appeal. It additionally directly addresses the additional allegations in saying that there's just no evidence to support them. That is a merit-based refusal.
Counsel, let's assume that there was a merits review. And then help us work through our case law and some more recent Supreme Court developments, because you rely heavily on Camp.
Yes.
The language in Camp, is, as I read it, it could sound like language of futility. That is, with a substantive determination having already been made at the highest level, any notion that Camp must jump through further administrative hoops, you know, the panel analogized to a Joseph Heller metaphor. But a few years after Camp, we decided Brown and held that there was not a futility exception to the PLRA.
Yes.
Does Brown bring Camp into question?
I don't believe so. I believe that Camp stands on its own terms in that it creates a merit-based or waiver exhaustion. Not even an exception, I would say. This is choosing to consider whether the basic purpose of PLRA exhaustion has been satisfied in the factual circumstances before the court.
Well, you're suggesting that it actually constitutes exhaustion, but Camp also, introducing its rationale, emphasizes that under the PLRA, a prisoner need only exhaust such administrative remedies as are available, suggesting that the reasoning that follows is explaining why this is not available. But we now have Ross that identifies three circumstances and identifies only three in which remedies are unavailable. Does Camp survive Ross?
Camp does survive Ross. I believe that Camp is setting forth it. Camp is addressing the factual circumstances before it, for sure. And in Camp, they had a circumstance where the inmate was arguably prevented from filing and also had a merits-based review of procedurally defective grievance. I believe that Camp sets forth two tests in that circumstance. And I think it's worth mentioning that the Third Circuit under Camp is not close to the same, to the only circuit that has come to this merits-based or waiver test conclusion. The Sixth Circuit, the Seventh Circuit, the Eighth Circuit, the Ninth Circuit, the Tenth Circuit, and the Eleventh Circuit have all found that the agency waives its right to claim.
Have any of those reaffirmed that after Ross?
Many of these are newer than Ross, actually. I actually didn't write down the dates, but a number of these came down either right before or right around the time of Ross, and did so under very factually different circumstances from each other. And in all those cases, there was not a reliance upon a way to get around the exhaustion requirement. It was more of a concept, the exhaustion requirement had been satisfied under the agency's own rules, because the agency had chosen to waive its procedural rules, and as a result, the court would do the same.
So is it your view, even though Camp talks about unavailability, that that's not in fact the basis for the decision?
I believe that it's part of the basis of the decision in Camp. It played a role in it, but I don't think that unavailability was necessary for the decision in Camp, that the waiver rule could apply.
Do you agree that the three circumstances listed in Ross are exclusive, or are they illustrative?
The circumstances in Ross indicate circumstances where inmates can waive the need to properly exhaust, can be excluded or excused from not properly exhausting. I believe the Camp, on the other hand, provides sort of a different way to properly exhaust.
You had mentioned we should consider this exhaustion because it was, in fact, addressed on the merits.
Yes.
But Woodford talks about other benefits that go along with proper exhaustion, including improving the quality of prisoner suits eventually filed, because proper exhaustion often results in the creation of administrative record that's helpful in court. Witnesses can be identified and questioned while memories are still fresh, and evidence can be gathered and preserved. Isn't this a case in point where the regional administrator had to deny the appeal because there had not been a filing at the first level and therefore not an opportunity for investigation and administrative record to be created for review by either the regional administrator or now that Mr. Rinaldi has proceeded to federal court by the district court?
I believe that the regional office reviewed itself the record to supporting or not supporting Mr. Rinaldi's additional allegations. The regional office could have rejected these additional allegations and directed Mr. Rinaldi to file them below for further investigation, but instead it reviewed the record and found that there was insufficient evidence to support these allegations. In short, the regional office found that there was sufficient evidence for them to decide this, and that sufficient evidence was that there was no evidence.
You wouldn't have any problem with the conclusion that had the regional office not even mentioned the argument, it would be waived.
I think that if the regional office had not mentioned the argument, it would be a much harder case. If they had not mentioned them at all, then it would be difficult to show a merits-based denial. However, in this case, that isn't what happened. They did address it. They addressed it both in...
Very briefly, it was addressed in the conclusion was that there was no merit to it.
But agreed.
My question is, had it not mentioned it at all, wouldn't it have been waived?
I think that if it was not mentioned at all, it would be more of a circumstance where discovery would be appropriate, where Mr. Rinaldi should have the opportunity to determine whether or not it was considered and folded into as part of the grievance denial.
I'm sorry, but what would the discovery be?
Obviously the BOP is the only party to this case that would have any evidence of what the regional office did with the additional allegations. Maybe there are notes, and there could be some evidence that would help Mr. Rinaldi in finding whether or not there was a merits-based decision. That's not the case we have here, but if it was, I do believe it would be more of a situation where some discovery would be appropriate.
If they had simply rejected it on procedural grounds because it wasn't raised below, if it was an REJ dismissal, then wouldn't it be a clear-cut procedural default?
Then yes. Then it would be a clear-cut procedural default. I believe the circumstance that I was just considering is if we had the same response, but it did not directly mention the additional allegations. It was a merits-based denial of the entire grievance without directly addressing the additional allegations.
Do you want to briefly address the discretionary function exception argument, and specifically
sure.
The characterization of the act at issue? Because the exception seems to stand or fall here on how narrowly or broadly that act is characterized. Why,
yes.
Why should we consider it as something as narrow as placing an inmate in a cell with someone who has already threatened to kill him?
I think that the discretionary function exception here really turns on the fact that Mr. Rinaldi has alleged that the decision to place him in a cell with this particular inmate who he contends appellees knew had directly threatened to kill him if he was placed in a cell with him does rise to the level of an Eighth Amendment violation.
No, sorry, I was asking about the discretionary function exception.
Yes.
Why shouldn't we consider the act in question simply the housing of cellmates and decisions regarding compatibility of cellmates, which at that level seems a matter of discretion for the BOP?
Right. We do not contest that generally the decision of where to house inmates is a discretionary one within the BOP. The Third Circuit has found this in the past. It's been found by pretty much universally throughout the country by courts that have considered it. So we don't contend that as a general matter those decisions do fall within the discretionary function exception. We, however, argue that in this factual circumstance before the court today, because Mr. Rinaldi alleges that the house decision here rose to the level of an Eighth Amendment violation, that it does not fall under the discretionary function exception because unconstitutional acts cannot be discretionary under established Third Circuit law.
I'm fine.
Okay. All right, we'll hear from you again on your model. Thank you.
May it please the Court, I'm Timothy Judge from the United States Attorney's Office of the Middle District of Pennsylvania, representing appellees in the United States of America. I would like to turn first to the exhaustion issue that the Court spent the most time with my colleague on. Certain facts I'd like to highlight for the Court in the record. First, the filing with the initial informal resolution, the BP-8, for Administrative Remedy 675165. So that's the first in time. Was filed informally with the Bureau of Prisons.
Is that the assault or the retaliation request?
It's the only one that has any description in the record as to what was alleged by Mr. Rinaldi. So this was originally filed as to the selling of inmates forcibly, as Mr. Rinaldi alleged, despite the screening process or the compatibility. So
we're talking
about
the Eighth Amendment assault.
That was the only initial filing at the informal level for the first-in-time administrative remedy.
I thought the first complaint that he filed had to do with an inmate. We're talking about two cellmates. And the first one actually assaulted him, and he filed a complaint with regard to that. And then, you can correct me if I'm mistaken, on appeal, he added the selling with putting him in a cell with one who had threatened his life.
He initially complains that he was assaulted by a prior cellmate in the informal resolution, the BP-8 that was filed in the first in time. That's correct. He says that was as a result of the screening and compatibility determinations by the Bureau of Prisons, and that despite the compatibility determinations, the BOP should not force inmates to be celled. So the crux of his complaint at the informal level for the first in time was challenging the Bureau of Prisons' forced selling of inmates despite whatever screening process the BOP employed.
Right.
And then he filed an appeal of the denial with the warden.
Not a separate complaint. So it's that appeal that we are talking about.
That's correct.
In terms of the retaliation.
Excuse me. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Did that also include the assault as well by the first selling?
The initial one? The initial did not state anything about an assault as to any cellmate. I need to correct that. I'm sorry, Your Honor. In the record at JA 162, that's the initial BP-8. And there's no addressing in any assault by any cellmate. It's merely addressing whether or not the Bureau of Prisons should be allowed to force inmates to cell together.
JA 160 was his initial informal resolution attempt. It says, I was assaulted by a previous cellmate. And it goes on to tie this to his request the institution discontinue the practice of forcing inmates to cell together.
I stand corrected, Your Honor, yes. So he raised the assault of the individual inmate. The denial of his informal resolution strictly spoke to the standards that the Bureau of Prison employed, but it didn't contain any allegation as to the February 2nd assault.
Well, it hadn't happened yet.
It hadn't happened yet. That's correct.
But he appealed that it happened, so he included that in the appeal. Why? I understand your argument that there's not exhaustion because 542.15b2 doesn't permit issues to be raised for the first time on appeal. But why is it really a different issue rather than another example of the same issue? That is, the declaration of Michael Romano at JA 155 describes the grievances at BP's levels 8, 9, and 10 as, quote, raising the same issue, close quote, and all address the practice of forcing inmates to cell together regardless of compatibility.
Assaults can differ. I mean, there could be different bases for them. In this particular case, he initially brought to the attention of the Bureau of Prisons through the grievance process a challenge to the screening provisions of the Bureau of Prison of how they classify and sell cellmates. He raises as an example of the results of those process the initial assault by the other cellmate. He then impermissibly includes in the appeal to the region an additional assault on February 2nd that, based on his complaint, was the result of retaliation by a staff member with some sort of animus against him.
Well, that's conflating the First Amendment retaliation request with the assault request. We're talking here about the Eighth Amendment claim and whether that claim in the district court is exhausted or not.
And our position is that it's not, because he's not permitted to raise that for the first time on appeal.
But what is it that he's raising for the first time on appeal? Is it a new issue, or is it simply another example of the same issue?
Well, I don't see a way to distinguish between, I see the assaults distinguished in the fact that one he's asserting was based on compatibility screening provisions by the Bureau of Prisons, and the other he's asserting that it was based on retaliation. So I see the two assaults as different and distinguishable, and although the result, the actions of assaults by other prisoners, may be the same, because they're the result of different activities by employees of the Bureau of Prisons, that those two issues are actually distinct and separate. So
his retaliation request was filed initially as a sensitive request with the regional administrator was a different request with a different number than this assault request talking about.
That's correct.
And the appeal, the administrative remedy appeal, at J167, while including the new assault, concludes, I'm requesting the institution stop forcing me to cell with another person, regardless of our compatibility.
Correct.
Isn't that why Mr. Romano, in his declaration, says that this is raising the same issue as was raised in the two prior requests, the two prior complaints?
I believe it could be read that it's the same issue as far as selling compatibility. To the extent that he alleged in his appeal to Northeast Region that he had been threatened by his cellmate. He never uses the word assault. He doesn't state in his appeal to Northeast Region that he was assaulted. He says he was threatened, killed by the second-time inmate that he was celled with after February 2nd. So because he was threatened, it is reasonable to view the Northeast Region appeal as being part of the complaint concerning the screening provisions of the Bureau of Prisons.
But it is based on new facts, isn't it?
It would be new facts as far as the second-in-time threat, yes.
According to his claim, as I understand it, a retaliation based on his filing frequent and constant complaints.
That was his allegation in his complaint.
And you say that was not exhausted.
That's correct.
But if the regional director takes the complaint and addresses it on the merits and says there is no merit to it, why isn't that preserved?
In this case, the Northeast Region didn't address whether or not there was any retaliation by any staff member. They merely had the allegation that my cellmate that I was transferred to after February 2nd threatened to kill me.
But whether or not they addressed it on the merits is another question and one we can talk about. But I understand Judge Fuentes' question, and I share it, to be whether if it was addressed on the merits, then under our case law in Camp and Spruill, do you agree it was exhausted?
No, because the Bureau of Prisons has a specific regulation that prohibits it from being raised for the first time on appeal. And I believe that Camp is far more limited than stating that there's waiver by the agency. I believe in that those particular circumstances by Camp, the court found that because he had been he had transferred outside of the prison of his initial allegations. He had raised a complaint that was ultimately vetted by the highest authority for the Department of Corrections. In that case, it found that no further exhaustion was necessary. The court brought up Brown, and that subsequent to Camp, Brown was decided. Even before Camp, this court had decided Nias versus Reno, and that was in 2000. So that predates Camp, that predates Brown, where futility was recognized. So I believe that because futility is not an exception to the exhaustion requirements, and this court has recognized that as far back as 2000, which predates Camp, then Camp finds in the particular facts and circumstances that were presented in that case that no further exhaustion would be required. And then Brown subsequently being decided limits Camp to its very factual specific situation.
Can I ask exactly what was before the Northeast Regional Director? It's clear that the improper selling or improper procedure screening was before them, correct?
Correct.
And it's clear that the assault with the initial selling inmate was before them.
Correct.
So then there's two others. There's the subsequent selling with the inmate who had threatened to kill him.
Correct.
Was that, and then there was the retaliation claim.
Correct.
Which of the last two, if any, were before Northeast Region? I mean, raised before the Northeast Region, but was done.
The only allegation that would have, that could possibly, if this court were to find that he was waived from exhausting before the Northeast Region, was that he was threatened by his current cellmate. There was no allegation of assault by him in that appeal to the Northeast Region.
All right. And you say possibly because it might be included as part of the whole course of conduct, or is it your position that it's an independent matter and should have been raised at the lowest level?
It's an independent matter that should have been raised at the lowest level.
And the same with respect to the retaliation?
That's correct.
Wasn't he the second selling, wasn't he assaulted in the cell?
The allegation arises for the first time in the complaint that he was assaulted for the three-week period after February 2nd.
In the second selling?
In the second cell, that's correct.
Which is one of the basis for the retaliation claim.
That's correct.
Counsel, you're saying that arises for the first time in his federal complaint?
The assault, assaults stemming from February 2nd, the first time that he makes that allegation of assaults is in his complaint. Now, we take as true that he filed it with the sensitive remedy. There was no evidence presented to the district.
Now you're talking about the retaliation claim.
Now we're talking about the sensitive filing. There's no evidence in the record as to what was contained in that claim.
Okay, but we're talking about the assault claim,
right,
that's raised in his federal complaint and whether that's exhausted. At JA-187, which is his appeal to the regional office, he complains of being assaulted by the former cellmate. Then he says that his current cellmate threatened to kill him. And then he says that he has already been assaulted and lost a tooth. As I read it, as a result of being housed with that cellmate before again requesting that the institution stop forcing him to cell with a person regardless of compatibility. How does that not raise an argument as to a claim of assault by his second cellmate?
As I read it, that set of factual circumstances, I don't have the record site before me, was part of the first cellmate that he alleged assaulted him, the loss of the tooth. That's the same factual allegations he made in regard to that assault. And that it doesn't pertain to the second allegation in his complaint. He never alleges he lost a tooth. In regards to the second assault, he alleges he received several cuts and bruises as a result of the 3 weeks of assaulting from February 2nd and on.
Does the record reflect that at the prison level there was any investigation, any records of what happened as a result of their assault?
There's nothing presented to the district court. The only facts that were before the district court would have been the notation by the Northeast Region that said there was no record of an assault by a previous cellmate or the current cellmate. That's the only indication in the record that I'm aware of.
You argue that we can distinguish Camp on its facts, and you were pointing to Brown. But post-dating Brown is our decision in Spruill. And in Spruill, we held that exhaustion under the PLRA includes a procedural default component, that whether there's been proper exhaustion is made by evaluating a prison's compliance with the prison's, a prisoner's compliance with the prison's administrative regulations governing inmate grievances and the waiver, if any, of such regulations by prison officials. We also concluded in Sproul that where one of his claims had not been raised but was then addressed on the merits sua sponte by a prison official, that it was deemed exhausted. Why doesn't Sproul make clear camp survives as well, and that under our governing case law, if there has been address of an issue on the merits, that a claim is exhausted?
I think camp survives. I think Sproul makes clear that waiver is possible by the agency.
So you agree under our controlling case law, if we conclude that the regional administrator did address his claim, his Eighth Amendment assault claim, on the merits, that it's properly exhausted for purposes of federal court?
Yes, that would be the position based on the standing precedent currently.
And the government is not taking the position that that Sproul or Camp are called into question by Woodford or Ross?
No.
So you would be disagreeing with the district court on the exhaustion of the first assault?
The first assault, that's correct, that was presented at every level to the Bureau of Prisons.
Was exhausted. Okay.
But I believe that allegation was also part of a prior civil case, a civil action. The crux of his allegation in referring to that first time assault, I believe, was to bolster his claim that he shouldn't be forced to sell inmates despite the screening process by the Bureau of Prisons. I believe he used that as factual recitation as to why he should be forced to. So,
are you still on the first cellmate? Or
first cellmate, yes, sir.
Okay. I thought the question was about the second.
I'm sorry, I thought he was on the first cellmate.
I may have been confused. What about the second cellmate? Then? Was that a...
That was not exhausted.
All right. That's what
we agree with the district court that was not exhausted, and the district court should decision to dismiss that claim for not exhausting should be affirmed.
But what about the sensitive issue?
So taking as true his allegations in his complaint that he raised in his sensitive complaint the February 2nd forced selling transfer and then subsequent assaults. We don't know because the record's silent on that, and there was no evidence, contrary evidence, presented before the district court. So taking it as true is that was presented. It was rejected by the Northeast region with direction to file with the local level.
You would say the exhaustion issue was not exhausted? Is that correct?
For that second remedy, that's correct.
Even though the regional director addressed it and denied it on the merits?
For the second remedy, for the alleged February 2nd assaults, that was not, so I need to make the distinction. We're not talking about the Northeast region appeal. We're talking about the census remedy filed directly with the Northeast region.
That's the retaliation complaint.
Retaliation
complaint, that's correct.
And you don't dispute that his retaliation request was filed as sensitive, or that he appealed to the general counsel? In other words, you're not arguing a failure to exhaust because of either of those circumstances?
I'm sorry, can you please repeat the question?
Yes, you're not disputing that Rinaldi's retaliation request was filed as sensitive?
No, I'm not disputing that at all.
And the government also does not dispute that he, in fact, appealed to the general counsel?
Over the procedural process, that's correct. He was informed that it was rejected, not denied. So as opposing counsel indicated, that was procedurally improper to take an appeal from a rejected sensitive remedy that was rejected. He was given instructions as to how to properly exhaust and then didn't avail of himself of that process.
So your position is the merits were not considered at that point?
That's correct.
And what does rejected mean? That you have to start at the lower level?
That you need to follow the direction the agency had given you to properly exhaust. In this case, the lower level.
You go to the warden, or do you go to the informal proceeding?
The indication by the rejection code in the record indicates to file with the warden at the institution.
Could he have taken that decision and gone to the general counsel instead of going back?
No, because a rejected remedy can't be appealed. It's never addressed. Only a denied remedy can be appealed to the general counsel.
The Rinaldi claims that he was intimidated or thwarted from going to the lower level. If the lower level is to start with the warden, would the people that he's claiming were intimidating him, would they necessarily know? They wouldn't be in the decision-making process. Or what would they know about that? I'm just trying to figure out the process here.
I don't believe the record addresses exactly what would happen if he filed at the institution level. I don't know what the warden would do if the warden would address it himself, or if he would delegate it to somebody, and who that person would be. I don't believe that's in the record, and I wouldn't want to speculate on that.
But the allegation, or as I understand the argument of Rinaldi, is that he would have been intimidated if it went to the warden. Somehow that would have thwarted him from filing, deterring him from filing other administrative complaints, and place him at risk with people that he thought were intimidating him. Am I interpreting?
That appears to be his argument, Your Honor, and that takes us back then to what should the standard be, because Ross didn't announce a standard as to when or how a court should determine that a grievance process is unavailable.
You don't dispute that the objective prong would be satisfied in these circumstances?
No, I don't dispute that. A claim about inmate safety and retaliation that could result in assaults, I think reasonable minds can all agree, is an objectively serious allegation.
And that is to say, in terms of what that objective prong means, that a reasonable prisoner of reasonable fortitude would be deterred from filing a retaliation complaint with the very institution that he was alleging had retaliated against him previously.
I believe that's a reasonable conclusion, Your Honor.
So the government's argument is only as to the subjective prong, if we conclude that there is a subjective in addition to the objective prong.
That's correct. And the reason why the court should employ the subjective prong is because it's more faithful to the purpose of the PLRA, to limit frivolous litigation, to limit the amount of prison litigation that's not first attempted to be resolved by the institutions themselves at the administrative level.
If that were the case, Rinaldi says that he still would have been intimidated in this circumstance.
And the record belies that. And as looking at his record, his complaint alleges that he filed more than 50 administrative remedies in the 1 year that he was at USP Lewisburg.
Are any of the 13 that followed his filing of the sensitive request retaliation complaints?
Not specifically retaliation, but the July 2012 administrative remedy specifically was a complaint that his administrative grievances were not being investigated. And so that could be reasonably construed to include any allegations of cell placement or assault or retaliation.
Do you agree, if we conclude there is a subjective prong, that a remand is required, that the district court would need to make a finding of his active state in the first instance?
I believe the record indicates that he wasn't thwarted, that he had remedies available. He took routine advantage of the process. He understood it.
Are you arguing that the fact that he filed unrelated to complaints about things like failure to investigate or absence of cleaning supplies means as we should find as a matter of law that that precludes a finding that he was subjectively deterred from filing a retaliation complaint?
I believe that is the totality of his record permits the court to determine the factual record before it and what was before the district court to affirm the district court's decision. What this court can affirm based on anything supported by the record, and in this case the record that was before the district court and is before this court, supports he wasn't thwarted.
But no record was developed as to his subjective state of deterrence, correct?
If subjective state of deterrence is his mental state, specifically there was no finding by the district court as to whether or not he felt deterred. It was a determination based on his filing history.
You have us make that determination in the first instance.
I don't believe the court needs to make a determination as to inquire, whether it be by testimony or some sort of other affidavit that he would file, because assuming that he would assert, I felt deterred, take that as what he would say, and he would say that is his subjective state of mind. The record would belie that assertion by him because of the numerous amounts of filings that he made, including one challenging the administrative grievance investigations for his complaints.
You had stated earlier that only a denial can be appealed to the general counsel. I want to make sure I understand how these rules work together, because 541.14d, dealing with sensitive requests, says where it's rejected that the inmate may pursue the remedy by submitting to the warden, not that the inmate shall or must. And then we have 542.17c, which deals with all rejections and which specifically references rejection on the basis of 542.14, the sensitive request. And there says that if an inmate is not given an opportunity to correct the defect and resubmit, then they may simply appeal to the next level. Where the rejection is because the BOP concludes that it's not a sensitive request and the inmate believes it is a sensitive request, what is there for the inmate to correct? What defect is there for the inmate to correct and resubmit?
The fact that he didn't follow the directions to go back to the institution level and give them, the institution, an opportunity to correct any problems at the institution level, develop the record at that level in the first instance. The provision that Your Honor just recounted indicates that if there was, if the inmate's not given an opportunity to make a correction, then they may appeal. In this case, he was directed, please file with the institution if you feel that that this matter needs to be pursued. It shouldn't be at this level.
But he considered it a sensitive request. So where is the defect for him to correct there? Why isn't it proper exhaustion under 542.17c for him to simply appeal to the general counsel, as that section says he may do?
Well, the institution holds out their regulations for the inmates to follow, not based on the subjective determinations by the inmates as to what process they should follow. Otherwise, the inmates would be able to determine, unreviewed, whether they should file a sensitive matter versus an institutional matter, and then the exception could swallow the rule that
he
should follow.
But isn't that exactly why 542.17c specifically addresses rejections on the basis of the sensitive request provision, and both of them provide that the inmate may take a course of action, may refile with the institution, or may appeal?
I would agree if the institution hadn't given directive to the inmate to
file. Where's the evidence of that in the record?
It's that the code for rejection typically means there is nothing in the record that says that he was specifically directed. We don't have any correspondence to support it, but that the general practice for that code means the inmate was directed to then refile at the institution level.
Where is there anything in the record about that general practice?
That's in the record with the administrative codes that explain in the administrative what the three-letter codes are. REJ is one of those codes, and that for the denial, for the rejection of the sensitive filing, and that indicates when you look at the definition in the record that, in fact, they are told to go and file at the institution level when that code comes up.
Is that something that discovery would be helpful?
I don't think discovery is necessary due to the procedural rejection of the sensitive remedy and the inmate not availing himself of refiling as directed.
Well, you talk about our general practice and so forth. I'm trying to think if this can be resolved on the regulations and the details of the regulations. You talked about the codes that were used. Could you explain that again?
There's a index of codes as to what they mean when they're contained within the database for the Bureau of Prisons, and it lists what the three-letter code means when it's put into the system. So in this particular case, for the sensitive remedy, when the Bureau of Prisons referred to their system, there's a REJ code, and it indicates that for sensitive remedy, when the REJ code is identified in the database, the inmate was told to refile at the institution level.
Are you talking about JA-180?
I don't have it specifically before me, Your Honor, but it would be the glossary of codes. I'd be able to provide it. If the court would bear with me, I could refer to the record. I have it.
Well, the REJ-FRM on JA-180 indicates it means you did not submit your request or appeal to the proper form or on the proper form.
Let's see if I can.
Do you know which REJ code it was?
I believe it's indicated at JA-155, Your Honor, in which he was advised to refile at the institution level.
If I can understand your position a little bit better, is it the case when a sensitive matter is filed directly with the regional director, whether it remains a sensitive matter is solely within the hands of the regional director?
That appears to be the way the regulatory scheme by the agency is designed, yes. That the agency, the Northeast Region, can review it and make the determination.
And under no circumstances can the matter remain sensitive while it is filed with the with counsel, with general counsel.
As to an appeal of that?
That's right.
I believe because it was rejected and not denied. A denial would mean that it was accepted on the merits, and then an appeal from whatever decision was made would be procedurally appropriate. However, with a rejection, there's no process for appeal. They were directed to refile at the institution level. So in that response, the Northeast Region's decision would be final.
Counsel, I'm looking at JA-155 on the written complaint. And there it says the reason for the rejection was coded as, quote, INS, close quote.
I'm sorry.
The status code reflects that the code indicates he failed to first file at the institution level.
I'm sorry. I stand corrected. It's not REJ. It's an INS. That's correct, Your Honor.
And how does that instruct him that he's required to do that, to then file before the institution?
I don't know exactly how the inmate was notified that he was to file. Opposing counsel doesn't dispute that he was instructed to refile.
But this is the kind of case that would be filed initially with the administration or the warden.
He could. He could have instituted at the institution level. He chose to file a sensitive remedy, which was then he was notified to file at the institution level.
But as you've conceded, an inmate of reasonable fortitude would be deterred under these circumstances from filing a retaliation complaint at the institution level.
They could be. They also may not be. That's why the subjective component is important for the court, for their consideration of whether remedies were unavailable.
You previously said that you were not contesting the objective prong.
That's correct, and we're not.
So that is satisfied as to a reasonable prisoner being deterred.
That's correct. So if it's an objective standard only, then that would be satisfied. That's correct, Your Honor.
So are you saying that there's no need then to go to the institutional level, that taking an appeal to the general counsel would exhaust in these sensitive complaint cases?
If the Northeast region agreed in this particular case procedurally, they informed the inmate to file at the institution level. Implied in that is that the region didn't believe that it was a sensitive matter or that it could best be addressed at the institution level.
But whether we reverse and remand, given your argument, turns on whether we conclude that the subjective prong can be satisfied or undermined, as the case may be, as a matter of law by the filing of unrelated complaints.
That's correct. And I believe, though, that the administrative grievance investigation is related. It is not directly the same issue, and it's not directly on point, apples to apples, but I believe that his filing complaining about investigation of his administrative grievances is similar enough to demonstrate he wasn't deterred from filing administrative grievances.
Counsel, do you want to briefly address the issue of the discretionary function exception? And specifically, why shouldn't we characterize the act here as the district court did? And that's in terms of him being housed with an inmate who had already threatened to kill him. Under those circumstances, isn't there specific instruction in the statute and the responsibility of the BOP to provide for the safety and protection of inmates?
It doesn't address specifically how the Bureau of Prisons should classify or house inmates together. That's left to the discretion and the sound correctional judgment of the employees of the Bureau of Prisons.
But that's only if we characterize the act at that level of generality.
That's correct.
Well, why shouldn't the act be characterized as the district court did, with much more specificity? The housing of an inmate with a cellmate who had already threatened to kill him.
Even if it's characterized as that, it would be the standard under the FTCA is a negligence standard.
Are you suggesting there's not in the mandate to provide for the protection and safekeeping of inmates, that would not specifically preclude the housing of an inmate with another cellmate who had threatened to kill him?
I think that the Bureau of Prisons are confronted with numerous situations where inmates may make statements about what they would do with cellmates that were put in with them, specific or general, and they have to investigate those instances and make determinations as to what the level of the threat is to the inmate. Is it credible, based on their knowledge and history of the inmates, as to what the compatibility between those inmates are and what the risk is to the inmates, and determine whether or not, based on their resources and availability of housing, whether or not it's still appropriate to lodge them together or keep them together. Inmates routinely try to manipulate housing assignments for various reasons. So based solely on the allegation of he threatened to kill me, I think there's a far larger consideration for the agency to determine appropriate housing than just that statement. That statement may be enough in and of itself to cause the Bureau to take some action with regard to housing. However, I believe that there's far more considerations that they have to take into account before coming to their decision as to what's appropriate. And so, based on that, the discretionary act is, I think, appropriately characterized as what, even at the district court levels, taking that as the conduct that the district court, that an inmate who alleges he was placed in a cell with another cellmate who threatened to kill him, still is a discretionary action that has to be resolved by the Bureau of Prisons in their judgment and expertise.
Is this a claim that he characterized as a negligence claim?
The complaint is silent as to what his basis for invoking the FTCA is. The allegation is, under the Eighth Amendment, I was retaliated against, I was assaulted. Under the First Amendment, I was retaliated against. Under the Eighth Amendment, I was assaulted. There's no invocation of any state-recognized tort.
But I mean, isn't this the way he characterizes his claim?
He characterizes his claim broadly as that it's violative of the Eighth Amendment.
As what?
As it violates the Eighth Amendment.
All right. I thought I saw this also characterized as a negligence claim.
Well, he does. He says, and he invokes the FTCA.
I mean, it really can't be both, can it?
There can be overlap, I believe, between negligence and constitutional claims, and those are more widely seen in intentional torts.
How about negligence and discretionary action?
I don't see the overlap as far as cell assignments and housing. I don't see that overlap. The overlap that I've seen in the cases that appellant cites as far as the preclusion for that employees aren't permitted to violate the Constitution or statutes largely focus on intentional torts and the intentional tort exception to the FTCA. So in this particular case, there's no intentional tort that's been recognized under Pennsylvania state law that's been invoked in this case, either by the district court, by Mr. Rinaldi, or here on appeal. So absent an assertion of a recognized state tort, the district court was correct in its conclusion, albeit for a different reason, that it lacked jurisdiction under the FTCA.
Counsel, unless my colleagues have questions, I'd have just a couple on the amendment to the RFRA claim. We're dealing here with a pro se litigant. An amendment under Rule 15 is to be given freely. Why shouldn't we allow amendment? Is it the government's position that there's some prejudice to the government in allowing that amendment? And if so, what?
Mr. Rinaldi was, after the district court's decision, Mr. Rinaldi filed a motion for reconsideration. Part of that reconsideration was his First Amendment claim, but not the RFRA claim. Upon appeal, this court indicated that there was a clear indication by Mr. Rinaldi to stand on his complaint. So on that basis...
What is the prejudice to the government?
To defend a claim that is beyond the four-year statute of limitations of the statute. At this point, we're talking about allegations that occurred back in 2012 and witnesses and evidence that would be related to investigating a claim that occurred back then.
And but the government was defending that claim up until the point that it was rejected by the district court on the ground that he hadn't identified individuals.
Any personal involvement, that's correct.
So the only delay is in the course of the appeal if we were to remand and allow amendment, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor, but it would still be to try to find whoever he alleges now as being personally involved in the RFRA claim to then have to go back and recreate the events for 2012. And so that would be
the
prejudice.
What is the additional prejudice to the government given simply the lapse of time in pursuing the appeal?
It would merely be a resource issue, Your Honor. I can't point to any true prejudice that would say that the other than the expiration of the statute of limitations, it was dismissed. He had the opportunity to raise it. The finality of the proceedings are at stake, and the United States has an interest in that.
Okay. Thank you, Counsel.
Very much.
Ms. Ackerman, we'll give you 3 minutes if you want to take that long.
Thank you. I would first like to address the RFRA issue, as I did not address it initially. The fact that maybe 6 years have passed since these things took place to me like a poor reason to find that the government is at all prejudiced by bringing this claim back. I mean, the fact is that the facts of this claim were appealed.
Counsel, isn't there a more fundamental problem with this argument, and that is the very premise for our entertaining this appeal was that we had a final order because he was resting on his complaint despite the opportunity to amend.
Yes.
Are you asking us to revisit that question, and if so, does that call our jurisdiction over this appeal into question?
I'm not asking you to revisit that question. I am simply asking the court to consider the fact that the law did change after Mr. Rinaldi made the decision to appeal his Bivens free exercise claim rather than his RFRA claim. The law did change. Mr. Rinaldi is a pro se litigant. The government struggled to come up with any sort of actual prejudice, and that the equities here really call for the RFRA claim to be reinstated in the district court. Mr. Rinaldi should have a chance to litigate the facts of his free exercise claim, and that's really at this point the only way that he can do so given the change in the law after his appeal.
But the law changed as to a different claim, right?
Correct. It changed as to what the legal basis for his factual allegations could be.
So what authority is there that a change in the law as to a different claim means that a litigant who has foregone the opportunity to amend a complaint can change their mind on appeal and seek a remand for purposes of amendment?
Right. I have no law that I can cite to support that. The only argument that I can present is that this would be an equitable result here. There would be no prejudice to any party. The facts of this claim have been maintained, and that Mr. Rinaldi is a pro se litigant. And had he made this appeal with assistant counsel, I don't think that many counsel would have directed him to waive the RFRA claim, but that's not the circumstances that we have here today.
Would this, how would you write that in a precedential opinion? What would be the standard?
That's a question that I...
if I knew the answer, I wouldn't have asked it.
Yes. The only way that I can describe it would be an equitable decision on the court's part.
Would that be one that swept in any pro se litigant? What's the scope of that exception?
I believe that the circumstances in this case are unique. Mr. Rinaldi's... They're unique in that this issue was never raised for Mr. Rinaldi that the law may be changing. This issue was an issue in different circuits of whether or not the Bivens free exercise claim was viable. When Mr. Rinaldi first brought his claim, no one made him aware that this could be an issue. In addition to that, that and the law actually changing within this circuit in the process of his appeal, I think make this a unique situation. My time is up.
Counsel, thank you.
Thank you
both for your time and for entertaining many questions of the court on this long argument, which has been helpful to the court. For that reason, we'd also request that a transcript be prepared and that the parties split that cost.
Of course.
And we will take them under advisement.
Thank you.
I understand there may be a way that the costs actually are on the government in circumstance. We will ascertain that and put that in appropriate order. Thank you.
Thank you.